I'm very happy now to welcome Eric Jantz. He's a staff attorney with the New Mexico Environmental Law Center. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. I appreciate the opportunity.
So it seems like we're continually having you back on the radio to talk about the PIT rule. There's yet another hearing coming up about the PIT rule, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes. But first of all, what is it? What is the PIT rule? This is a New Mexico state law or rule. What is it?
Well, the PIT rule is a rule, a regulation that was created in 2008, enacted in 2008, that protects public health and the environment, particularly groundwater, from contamination from oil and gas field waste. Now, before 2008, what oil and gas companies did when they drilled a well was they would dump all the waste from that, and that includes all kinds of hydrocarbons, salty water, mud contaminated with hydrocarbons into a hole in the ground and bury it, essentially where they drill the well. And that, you know, those places are often on people's ranches, their farms, in their neighborhoods. And what this PIT rule did was it's the first time that New Mexico has attempted to comprehensively regulate oil and gas wastes in the field. And what it does, it required operators to manage their waste appropriately and encourage the use of recycling and what are called closed-loop drilling systems, which basically eliminates the need to build these holes in the ground. So essentially, it's taking the prior practice was to have all these toxic waste sites, burial sites, across New Mexico's landscape and require operators to either recycle their waste or take it to a centralized facility where groundwater is monitored and storage requirements are much more strict.
And I think, as you said, put liners in the pits so that the waste doesn't go into the ground and into the water.
Or at least make it so that the waste goes, it's a lot longer before the waste does go into the groundwater, because eventually liners degrade. That's why it's really important from an environmental and public health perspective to have waste recycled or hauled away to a centralized facility. And we took the position in 2008 that there should never be on-site waste burial, but the commission didn't take that position. But they still enacted a very, very good and very comprehensive rule that's now under fire.
What was the process by which this rule was passed? I mean, were all parties at the table, so to speak? Did the oil and gas industries participate in the making of this rule?
Absolutely. This was a very open and inclusive process back in 2006, 2007, and 2008. There was a year-and-a-half-long stakeholder process in which our clients, Earthworks Oil and Gas Accountability Project, participated, as well as ranchers, the New Mexico Cattle Growers Association, industry groups, individual oil and gas producers, and members of the general public. Then there were 3 weeks of technical hearings, after which the New Mexico Oil Conservation Commission enacted the PIT rule.
So to what extent has it been complied with? It's been, what, 4 or 5 years now?
Yeah, it has been 4 or 5 years, and generally the response from the public has been very good to this rule. In fact, the governor was presented with 12,000 signatures on a petition asking that the PIT rule be left alone because the ranchers and farmers and community members appreciate the fact that the oil and gas industry now has to manage its waste. Now, that said, the oil and gas industry is very hostile to this rule. We're trying to figure out why exactly, because they haven't given any specific reasons why, other than it cuts into their profits a little bit. We haven't seen any evidence presented by anybody that this rule is driving business out of New Mexico. The oil and gas resources are going to be exploited, so it's entirely unclear why the oil and gas industry wants to overturn this very sensible regulation.
I mean, you say it's about their profits. Have they presented any actual arguments?
They have presented arguments, but they haven't backed those arguments up with any data. You know, they've said, well, the oil and gas industry is suffering in New Mexico. But the fact of the matter is the oil and gas industry during the recession suffered everywhere. It's now bouncing back, and it's bouncing back in New Mexico as well. There's an oil boom in the southeastern part of New Mexico. Operators can barely keep up. So the regulation really doesn't play a part so much in the economics as does the world economic picture and global supply and demand.
So to what extent has the Pitt Rule and its implementation over these last 4 or 5 years actually produced a cleaner environment, if it has?
It has. We've had testimony from ranchers who have said that the Pitt Rule has made a huge difference in their lives, particularly those ranchers who have had closed-loop systems, the recycling systems on their ranches. Before the Pitt Rule, they said that there have been vast patches where pits have been dug where they can't grow anything, where there's no forage for their stock. But with a closed-loop system, the forage comes back, the natural landscape is restored, and they're able to conduct their business as if nothing happened. So it's been a huge benefit. There also have been no documented cases of groundwater contamination since the Pitt Rule was enacted. Prior to the Pitt Rule, there were over 400 documented cases of groundwater contamination from oil and gas operations due to pits.
So we have now cleaner water. We have happier ranchers and livestock. What about wildlife? Does the Pitt Rule protect non-domestic wildlife species?
Absolutely. In addition to just protecting the ecosystems and where wildlife lives, pits are oftentimes attractive for migratory birds. They'll land in pits. They're oftentimes, if they're not properly fenced, and oftentimes they're not, they'll be attractive to wildlife who thinks it's a place where they can drink. But, you know, as I said, there are really toxic things in these pits. So when wildlife and migratory birds are exposed to it, it often means that that animal will die. So, yeah, I mean, the fact that waste placement is centralized under the Pitt Rule, as well as the fact that recycling is encouraged, has definitely made a difference for wildlife.
My understanding is that some oil and gas companies are using the closed-loop part of the Pitt Rule anyway, and that that actually is economically beneficial for them. Is that true?
That's absolutely true. There's a tremendous amount of data from Colorado, from Wyoming, and other oil and gas-producing states that show that closed-loop systems actually save producers money over the long term. And it certainly saves them money in terms of liability, because they're not leaving any waste behind. There's a much reduced risk for contamination. So, I mean, it really is, over the longer term, a money saver for the oil and gas industries. And the oil and gas industry realizes that. It's my understanding that in the southeastern part of the state, the operators have moved almost exclusively to closed-loop systems.
So there's another part of this which I think is important to discuss, namely that let's say the oil and gas industry were to win, they were to overturn the Pitt Rule, they were to then start dumping toxic waste into the ground with impunity. It's not just that they would save a few dollars, but it's that it would cost the rest of society far more than they save, namely in the problems of health and well-being faced by human societies, kids, adults, livestock, and everybody else.
Well, that's absolutely true, but I mean, that's been the history of the oil and gas industry. They're happy to privatize profits, but they will, at every opportunity, try to socialize the costs of operations. So invariably, if given the opportunity, the oil and gas industry will try to put the costs of operations, both short-term and long-term, off on the public. And burying waste on site in a hole in the ground is one way to do that. But like I said, it's debatable whether or not the Pitt Rule even costs them any money over the long term. So I think that in some ways that's a straw man, that the economics favor doing away with the Pitt Rule. In some sense, this may just be an ideological effort on the part of the oil and gas industry. But in any event, I think that right now it looks increasingly likely that the pit rule will be substantially gutted because of the current administration's perspective on oil and gas and the amount of money the administration has received during the election cycle from that industry.
Is there nobody in either the Martinez administration or in the oil and gas industry who sees the value of clean land and water?
That's hard to say. The Oil Conservation Division, which is responsible for enforcing the pit rule, and the Oil Conservation Commission, which has been responsible for promulgating and now rolling back the pit rule, have been fairly silent on that issue. I mean, there's been, I suppose, some lip service paid to it. But, I mean, their actions belie what they say. The fact of the matter is that the industry is much more favored over the benefits, both economic and non-economic, of a clean environment and sound public health.
So there's another hearing coming up about this. It keeps coming up. Tell us about it, when, where, and how the public can get involved.
Sure. This is a supplemental hearing, and it was scheduled because the oil and gas industry based its petition on an older version of the pit rule that had been superseded. Pit rule was amended in 2009, and so essentially the oil and gas industry based its petition to roll back the pit rule on the wrong rule. The Oil Conservation Commission found itself in a difficult position and has decided it had to hold a supplemental hearing on the limited issue of the concentrations of waste that the oil and gas industry will be allowed to bury in pits. That hearing is on begins Wednesday at 9 in the morning at Porter Hall in the Wendell Chinu building on St. Francis Drive.
Here in Santa Fe.
Here in Santa Fe. And by law, the commission is required to allow public testimony. We encourage the people to come out and let the commission know that the pit rule is important, that it's doing what it was intended to do, that a clean environment and sound public health is important to New Mexicans, and that the pit rule shouldn't be disturbed.
And who are the people responsible ultimately for keeping or gutting the pit rule?
It's the New Mexico Oil Conservation Commission. It's a three-person commission. Two commissioners are appointed by the governor. One commissioner is appointed by the state land office, the land commissioner. We expect that the land commissioner's appointee is going to be interested in preserving at least some of the protections in the pit rule. But the two appointees from the governor have expressed their desire to accommodate industry and give industry what it wants.
Are they themselves members of the industry?
Not directly. One commissioner has worked closely with the industry in an academic setting, and the other commissioner has worked closely with the industry as a regulator for many, many years.
And so if the public wants to make its voice heard, they can show up on Wednesday morning at 9 o'clock and tell us again the place and address of the building.
Sure. It's in Porter Hall, which is in the Wendell Chinu building, 1220 South St. Francis in Santa Fe.
And if somebody can't make it to the hearing but they would still like to make their voice heard, what can they do?
They can submit written comments, and they can have those delivered to the Oil Conservation Commission, and they will be made part of the record.
Eric Jantz is a staff attorney with the New Mexico Environmental Law Center, which is on the web at nmelc.org. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
I appreciate it, Mary Charlotte.
I'm delighted to welcome to the program Sylvia Rodriguez. She's Professor Emerita of Anthropology and former director of the Ortiz Center for Intercultural Studies at the University of New Mexico. And on Tuesday, the 15th of January, she'll be speaking about acequias, activism, and collaborative research on acequias at 5:30 at the Santa Fe Community Foundation, sponsored by Amigos Bravos. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So let's start by talking about acequias and the history of acequias. I mean, these go back many centuries and go back far beyond New Mexico.
Right. Acequias are small-scale irrigation communities that took root and grew here in New Mexico during the colonial period. They're still operating and they're struggling to survive. The Pueblo people, of course, had their own techniques for managing water and were familiar with flood irrigation, although it was made probably in the northern part of the state, in the upper Rio Grande, not their mainstay. There were many ways, ingenious ways, of harvesting water and growing things. When the Spaniards came up, some think that, of course, they came up through Mexico, that some of the techniques that they brought were enriched by Tlaxcalan Indians, who they brought with them. But in any case, this whole body of technology and regulation and tradition came from North Africa and went into the Iberian Peninsula during the 800 years of Moorish occupation. So a lot of the, actually even the terms, but the practices and the technology of irrigation as we see here in New Mexico has its origins, its ancient origins in the Middle East and in the Iberian Peninsula. So when the Spanish came, they brought that, and Oñate, who had the first settlement colony in 1598 out of near where Okeohingé is now, according to their chronicles, one of the first things they did was dig ditches to divert water from the river to feed fields. And each of the communities that was established during the colonial period was either, first of all, near pueblos, who already had this rich tradition of agriculture. But what the Spanish brought, I think, transformed Pueblo agriculture in many ways and affected them in profound ways. But the first thing people had to do was dig ditches in order to divert water from tributaries or the main stem and dig this whole system of ditches and then administer these ditches to feed people's fields. So what grew up were these acequias en común, or these sort of community irrigation communities, that still are operating today in many parts of the state, primarily but not exclusively in northern New Mexico. Here in Santa Fe, there was a rich acequia tradition, much of which is now only operating in very small parts of the city. There was an archaeologist who, David Snow, who years ago did, a monograph for the city on sort of the history of acequias and mapped them. But, of course, the system is no longer really fully operative here right in the city, and that probably has some effect on how the river is going dry. But anyway, where I've done my work, of course, is primarily in the Taos area, where I worked on, I think it's probable that the Taos system is maybe the largest and most elaborate. If you take it as a whole, I mean, each of these tributaries, each of these little communities, Taos, like the settlement pattern of northern New Mexico along the Rio Grande and its tributaries, were sort of a central town in these outlying satellite communities. And that's what Taos is, the town of Taos, and then about 15 still existing pre-American colonial era and Mexican era communities, all of which are on ditches. And so the ditches are integral, and were one of the sort of backbones of community organization and cooperation. And the management and the governance of these systems is in itself a really interesting and important way of operating the commons, water as the commons. And New Mexico acequias really belong to a larger family of small-scale irrigation communities that you find all over the world, probably on every continent. And they're all facing similar problems, which is, of course, historically, as areas became colonized and then incorporated into nations, are these sort of bureaucratic centralized state systems that want to sort of take over the management and expand a lot of these systems and bring very different principles to operate rather than sort of a community-based, working the commons kind of thing. So this struggle against sort of bureaucratic, state-centered, centralized ways of operating you see all over the world, and also more recently bringing in, technologies such as fertilizer and, non-organic ways of trying to increase production. Here in New Mexico, there are many things that challenge the acequias. First of all, sort of the decline of farming. And after World War II, there was, less and less, fewer and fewer traditional Hispanic farmers, as well as, of course, the Pueblos, engaged in agriculture because it wasn't economically viable. And that's one of the things, is sort of people moving away from irrigated agriculture. But also with the growth of cities and development, the need to transfer water rights away from agriculture into other uses. Since all the water in the state, all the surface water is already allocated, there's no new water in the state. So one of the main sources for subdivisions, cities, places like Intel, is to transfer surface water away from traditional agricultural uses to other uses. So the transfer of water rights is one of the things that SAKS are sort of trying to control, trying to fight, and they've made some progress in that. So the water market, as the population and cities grow, the demand for water to non-agricultural uses is increasing, and so water rights are incredibly expensive.
Well, let's get back to that in a moment, but let's talk, it's very interesting the language you use to describe acequias. You call them irrigation communities, and of course community is a very human term, so it's not, you're not just talking about the physical fact of the ditch that's used or the canal that's being used to divert water, but the way it's used and how people do it. When you talk about water as commons, how have acequias traditionally been used and administered, and how did that work with the larger community that was farming around them?
Say you're on a stream that's a tributary of the Rio Grande. As in the case of the Taos Basin, which is where I'm most familiar, you have these sort of five streams right in the basin. Each of these streams, there is a mother ditch, an acequia madre, that diverts off of a stream, and off of that mother ditch are smaller laterals. These serve communities that are self-identified, that usually have, well, sometimes a centralized placita, sometimes a more dispersed pattern of settlement. They have their own chapel. They have their own, often their traditional penitente morada. They have their campo santo or their graveyard. They have their patron saint, who is the patron of their chapel. They're always part of a larger parish. Everybody who has a piece of farmland or land with water rights, which they've inherited, because we're talking about people who've been on the land for generations. And of course, the history of how a lot of that land was lost is another story in New Mexico, and that too has had a tremendous economic impact on farming here in New Mexico. But if you are a land owner and you have irrigated land, that means you're a parciante, which is that you're part of this acequia association. And there are rules of the ditch. Every year, the parciantes get together and elect a mayordomo or a ditch boss, who is traditionally a man, although there are now women mayordomos, who is really the person who allocates the water and is in charge of sort of distributing the water in times of scarcity, as well as when there's plenty of water in a good year of runoff. He or she is assisted by usually a three-person commission. And together, these elected officials really preside over all ditch business, that is, maintenance of the physical infrastructure. So acequia literally means the ditch, but when people talk about acequias, they also mean this association. And the principles by which the water is distributed is really one of sharing scarcity. It's not a zero-sum game, which is really how prior appropriation operates in state law and in Western water law, which is a very different principle, which means that in times of scarcity, really people sort of, no one goes completely without if it's physically possible, and people share the scarcity. In times of abundance, people can take water as needed, but they always sort of need to clear it with the mayordomo. So you have this sort of ditch boss, basically, who is someone who has to have intimate knowledge of the physical layout of the ditches. And when I was doing, I grew up on an acequia, so acequias go way back for me, and I think my love of a ditch is just my own experience as a child of hearing the ditch and playing with the ditch and the importance of the ditch in the neighborhood where I grew up. And it wasn't until many years later that I began to talk to and work with people on the acequias and understand how extensive and intimate their knowledge is of place and the kind of local knowledge they have, not only of the topography and how the water flows and the kinds of soils, but also of weather. And the managing a ditch, being a mayordomo, was a really tough job, and because people want their water when they want their water. So it's really a job that requires intimate knowledge of the physical infrastructure, of the behavior of water. Certainly, to be a mayordomo, one has himself or her else to be a farmer and to know how to irrigate. but also diplomacy, knowledge of people, an ability to read the weather, and to, during times of, you know, when if there's a storm in the middle of the night, to get out there, keep the ditches, keep the channels clear, and keep the water flowing and deliver the water to people in a timely fashion. If you're a paciente, your obligations are to pay your dues, and every ditch has dues to pay, to keep for, you know, maintain infrastructure, also sometimes to pay the mayordomos, who traditionally are either not paid or usually quite underpaid. But you need to also contribute labor to the maintenance of the ditch. And you'll see this, I've actually seen it in Acequia Madre a few years ago. I saw the mayordomo there cleaning the ditch. But everyone goes on a certain day. If you're a paciente, either you go yourself or you send, you know, a younger male person or a female person in your family, or you hire a peon to go and clean the ditch. And depending on how long the ditch is, people, that depends on how long it takes. So you, it's a contribution of communal labor to the maintenance of the physical system. That is the Acequia Madre. You're responsible for the ditches on your own land. So that's an important kind of secular ritual that takes place, that's for the maintenance of the ditch, but also is a time when people get together and, you know, gossip and find out what's happening. And it's the ditch, I think, is a way of not only delivering water and making it possible to live in the subsistence economy that grew up here, but today even, it's a kind of connectivity among people. I think you find people who are no longer subsisting, either mainly by farming, who are in part of the wage labor market or whatever, but who are tenaciously defending their water rights, which are under increasing demand because of the water market, but who hold to that piece of land and to the ditch because that's who they are. And they have a strong sense of community commitment and identity that's, I think, based on land and based on the system of acequia and interconnection, that sharing the water and allocating the water and having to deal with your neighbors in a cooperative way over a resource that's basically scarce. Fosters. And so you have these two sides of sort of competition on the one hand for water in this arid desert environment, and the on the other hand, cooperation, these two sides of the same coin.
We're talking to Sylvia Rodriguez. Let's talk for a moment about the historical relationship between the Spanish acequia communities and the pueblos in the Taos area. You were saying that the pueblos had their own way of doing irrigation, but were also affected by the acequia communities?
Sure. When the Spanish came, of course, they brought a whole suite of flora and fauna that changed, completely transformed the ecology of the area. One of the things the acequias did, and again, I think archaeologists aren't in complete agreement about how much actual flood irrigation in the upper Rio Grande the pueblos were doing. They were certainly familiar with it, and there's, and I don't want to get into, you know, who, I mean, to what extent that was the case, but with the coming of the Spanish and the Spanish colonial settlers, you had the extension of the digging of ditches where there weren't ditches before. And so what that did was extend the riparian habitat. So the landscape that we see today in New Mexico is a product of the acequias, because if you extend the riparian habitat, that means there's, you know, flora and fauna that goes along the borders of the ditch. And so the green of the area is largely, you know, always been concentrated along the rivers, the tributaries of the rivers, but then the acequias extended that. One of the things that has been, that parcientes have known for many years, but that has now been confirmed through scientific research, is that flood irrigation recharges the aquifer, which also can recharge the stream itself. So in this long history of Pueblo-Hispano relations is one of both competition and cooperation, and, you know, sort of a bittersweet relationship, but certainly with the introduction of old world crops and animals, it changed the landscape as well as agricultural practices in profound ways. And pueblos and their Hispanic neighbors had to share the water, and they did share the water. And in each area, I think the history and sort of the character of relationships is a little bit different, just like each community has its own personality. So you can make some generalizations, but really you sort of need to look at each particular community and its neighbors to understand the dynamics of what's been going on historically.
So each era seems to have its own kind of scarcity. In our current era, we have all these ways of diverting water and digging deep to get water, but we're also overusing it and creating scarcity once again. There was a big agreement signed in 2006 about which you've written, but talk about the dynamics of water and water rights in New Mexico, and in particular in northern New Mexico right now. I mean, as I understand, the person who has originally had the rights has first claim to the water. Is that correct?
With the coming of the Americans, you had legal developments that changed water law, new water laws. One of the principles of water in the West and here in New Mexico is prior appropriation. And that means that first in right, first in time. First in time, first in right, which potentially could be a zero-sum game in the sense that the oldest water rights in the Upper Rio Grande are held by the Pueblos, since they precede European and American. The next oldest water, and those water rights are not alienable, just like Pueblo land is not alienable. It's held by the tribes, and it's held in trust by the federal government.
And it's permanent.
It's permanent. The next oldest water rights are those held by the Acequias, and those go back hundreds of years in some cases, and establishing these priority dates is itself a problem. But those water rights potentially can be bought. I mean, one of the things that happens with the coming of American legal system is that water can be separated from the land. You can separate water, buy water rights separately and transfer them away from land. Previously, I don't think people thought about the possibility of doing that. It was unthinkable that you would simply sell your water rights, thereby leaving that piece of land from which the water rights have been sold forever fallow, forever barren. So there's this market for water rights. And one of the things that's had a tremendous impact, and I think it's been one of the triggers for Acequia activism, are the water rights adjudications, AMOT being the most famous one here in the Santa Fe area. There are many adjudications going on, and that's really to determine what the priorities are. Of course, these are legal cases that pit the Pueblos against all junior water rights owners. In the Taos area, the case was known as Abeta. And that went on these are some of the oldest legal cases in the American system. But I think that the Abeta case was, filed in either 67 or 69. It was settled recently out of court through a negotiated settlement that took more than 17 years of negotiated settlement between the Taos Valley Acequia Association, Taos Pueblo, and other claimants, the town of Taos, a couple of sanitation districts.
So what was at issue? Basically, gets the water?
Who owns the water rights, and in what priority, and how much, and for what? And all of these adjudications are going up and down the Rio Grande. And what kicked these off was really the San Juan Chama water, which was, since all the water is already allocated in the state, all growth along the Rio Grande is made possible by the importation of water from the Colorado River into New Mexico. Since the Colorado River doesn't really run through New Mexico, it runs, it's imported through these giant channels that were dug to bring water across the Continental Divide into the tributaries of the Rio Grande, and then the establishment of reservoirs to store that water. All of the growth of Santa Fe, of Albuquerque, and even of Taos is dependent on the importation of this water. And of course, water in the Colorado is going down. So this is one of the issue. I mean, this is such a complicated issue, I don't want to really get into all the details. But basically what these cases have done in the Pewaukee Basin and in the Taos Basin was to pit the Pueblo or the Pueblos against junior owners. And these are enormously complicated and slow-moving cases, and people have all kinds of opinions about them. The Taos settlement was reached and finally signed very recently. What it means basically is that because the importation of Colorado water does not take place in the actual flowing of physical new water into the Rio Grande is below where Taos is. They've dug all these wells to sort of take the water out of the ground to compensate for the water that will, in other words, they're taking water out of the ground instead of out of the river. That's true in Santa Fe. Of course, people started with the Buckman Wells started drinking the river. In Albuquerque, they started a few years ago drinking the river because the aquifers are not cannot be continuously mined. The bottom line is, with all of these increasing demands on water, and then, of course, the issue of climate change, the scarcity of water and the scramble for water is going to intensify. The pressure of the water market, the transfer of water rights, the water rights adjudication, development depending on the transfer of water right off the dishes are all factors that have contributed to the emergence of activism on the Acequias. You could say in a way that never before have the Acequias been so close to extinction, and at the same time never have they been so organized,
right,
and never have they been so studied and celebrated.
Well, one of the things that you're going to be talking about in your talk, we're talking to Silvia Rodriguez about acequias and about water, and is the scientific and academic and community collaborative research that's going on about acequias, which is fairly new and very exciting.
Yeah, I think what I'm going to be talking about is sort of the emergence of acequia activism, looking at particular instances, those that I'm most familiar with, which is when people on acequias began to organize, not just on one acequia, but between acequias, to form coalitions to fight certain kinds of trends of development. And one of the examples of that was back in the days of Indian Camp Dam in Taos, which John Nichols sort of fictionalized in the Milagro Beanfield War, when acequias on three different streams, and they called themselves Tres Valles, began to organize to fight what they thought would be detrimental ultimately to their water rights and to their farming. That was sort of a precursor. When the water rights adjudication in Taos y Abeyte case began to gear up in the 1980s, the Taos Valley Acequia Association emerged, which was really a federation of ditches on several streams in the Taos Basin. And they organized in order to meet the tremendous demands of preparing for the adjudication, including raising funds and organizing to inform people about the process, because each individual paciente had to get involved in establishing when their priorities were. And these organizations, the Taos Valley Acequia Association, and then later on the New Mexico Acequia Association, which is now the umbrella organization for acequias in the state, and they have regions where acequias are organized to sort of according to type, to meet the demands of the adjudication. And they've worked also on legislation that helps strengthen the position of acequias in several ways with respect to water rights transfers and also with water banking. But what you have is sort of the emergence, the slow growth of these coalitions of acequia associations and their organizations statewide at this point, not only for purposes of preparing for adjudication, but for education, for developing programs that help strengthen the traditions of the acequias, help farmers, get grants for infrastructure, inform people. So you have this sort of emergence of ever sort of greater levels of organization to meet the increasing demands and challenges that are facing people's ability to hold on to their water rights. These irrigation communities, of which acequias are one example in the world, are called by anthropologists autonomous irrigation communities. They're not politically autonomous in that acequia associations, for example, are subdivisions of the state and are subject to state statute and are regulated by state statute. But in the sense that you have these communities that in a very limited local way actually control their water supply, which if you look in the urban world today is a fairly unusual thing. The mutual domestic water associations do that too, and they have local control. And it's a form of communal cooperation that is, I think, very instructive and very, from which we can learn a lot.
Now, how are they working with scientists who are also studying acequias?
Well, one of the things I think is happening all over the world now, as we, people say the 21st century water is going to be one of the main crisis resources, is that there's a growth. You could say that the study of water scientifically, but also in a social science way, and all across the board, is a growth area now. I mean, the amount of publication and journals that are coming out dealing with water is expanding. As local areas, regional areas, nations are beginning to struggle more and more for water, as water, fresh water particularly is a limited supply, and you have increasing demands on it. So there's more study of water going on scientifically and in other areas. And of course, engineers and hydrologists have been studying water forever. But I think what you have now is the realization increasingly that the study of water can't be limited just to physical science, because this is economic, it's political, it's cultural, it's social. Water is something that sort of all areas of sort of human endeavor deal with. We can't live without this resource. So we're in an era now, which I call sort of a new era of the scientific study of acequias, here in New Mexico, as is going on all over the world. And one of the things I'm going to be talking about, and one of the main things, is sort of the emergence of multidisciplinary studies across, hydrologists working with range scientists, working with ecologists, working with biologists, now also working with social scientists to understand acequias as part of ecological systems. There's a very interesting study going on that's funded by the National Science Foundation, the PI, the main PI, Sam Fernald, who's done some really interesting
PI?
Work, primary investigator. NSF is now funding culture-nature coupling systems. And so this particular study is looking at three sites in northern New Mexico that's looking at acequias as part of an ecological system in the context of watersheds, which is a very holistic way of looking at them, not just as sort of these isolated or historically interesting institutions, but is really integral to the landscape and to the whole system of the watershed. So you have physical scientists working now with social scientists. Where I come in is, and where I've done work is as an anthropologist, is what is the nature of the sort of cultural traditions and the social traditions that are part of the acequia? You can't really understand the system without hydrology, without ecology, without biology, without range science. You need all of that. But you also need to understand sort of the values and the practices and the cultural institutions that are integral
to the maintenance. So talk a little bit about that.
Well, one of the things that this particular study is interested in is are there tipping points when an acequia system, which is a farming system, it's a community system, it's part of an ecological system, it's part of the watershed. What are the factors sort of all across these different dimensions that contribute to the maintenance and the resilience of this system? Because they're really studying resilience through time. These wouldn't be here if they weren't resilient and sustainable. What are the factors that contribute to resilience as well as challenge it, the threat? So they're trying to sort of figure out, are there economic tipping points? Are there tipping points in the terms of the quantity of water, with either through the transfer of water or the ultimate, I think, challenge is, legally, and you can try to fight water right transfers, but if the water supply, the physical water supply, which we know is increasingly going to be the case with climate change, that the runoff, the precipitation is going to go down, how can these be sustained? I mean, what are the various factors? And so one of the things we're looking at is people's values, the way they participate in the community. When you have to ask people, why do you still irrigate when you work in town, when your children have had to migrate out for education and employment, when the actual amount of stuff that you're growing has changed over the decades, and it's an important part of your household economy, but your mainstay is really other forms of making a living. Why is it so important to you? And what are the factors? What is it you get out of it? And why are people fighting so tenaciously to hold on to what is in fact a precious economic resource, but that is also like a whole institution by which people remain in touch with each other? So trying to understand the nature of sort of the cultural and the social aspects of acequias and how those relate to the economic and the sort of ecological aspect, looking at it holistically.
And as you said before, it's so much part of people's identity that that in itself is a motive.
Right. When you talk to one of the kinds of studies I've been talking about is sort of these multidisciplinary scientific studies. Another project is participatory action research. Traditional research done from universities is usually conceived of within the context of the university to address questions that are current in the discipline. And you sort of decide what questions you're going to research, you plan it out, and you go out and do it. Community-based participatory action research is research that really comes out of a community when a community of interest decides that they're facing particular issues and problems that concern them, and they decide that they want to find out how to deal with it, what the nature of that problem is and how to address it. So it's a very practical, pragmatic way of addressing issues of a community of interest. One of the projects I've been involved in is in collaboration with the New Mexico Acequia Association around what they call the Mayor-Domo crisis, which is that the old Mayor-Domos are dying. They're taking their knowledge with them, and it's getting harder and harder to recruit young people to become Mayor-Domos. So in collaboration with the NMAA, sort of a team of us worked to address the Mayor-Domo crisis, which involved going out and talking to Mayor-Domos and finding out, you know, what is it they do, how do they do it, how do they learn what they were doing, in order to develop a program to recruit and train a new generation of Mayor-Domos.
Did it work?
It's in process now. It's been a really exciting and maybe one of the most rewarding research projects I've ever done, because it's completely team, it's completely participatory in the sense that there's Mayor-Domos, commissioners, a graduate student, staff from the New Mexico Acequia Association, myself, engaged in the different stages of this research project, which started with what an academic would call interviews with Mayor-Domos, but what they call pláticas, which are chats that were recorded, talks that were recorded and then analyzed to find out what is it Mayor-Domos actually do. And so sort of eliciting these oral pláticas from these traditionally very knowledgeable, skillful people about the nature of their knowledge and the complexity of what they do in order to, again, address the crisis and see if we can, in fact, succeed in interesting a new generation of people to become Mayor-Domos and the nature of this knowledge. The traditional way people learned all this stuff, of course, which is can't be replaced, is by doing it and by watching your elders do it.
Right. I would think that they would say, oh, well, everybody knows how to do this. We grew up doing it. And the very idea that it would disappear is probably sort of crazy.
Well, the incentives, you know, are not. I mean, it's like just like farming in this very difficult environment. It's getting harder and harder to do that.
Yeah.
I think people are beginning to realize that we're in big trouble if that goes away in any number of ways. I mean, you have young suburban kids taking up organic farming today, you know, and the whole food security movement and food movement are part of this, I think, larger development of sort of reevaluating local knowledge, local production,
exactly,
and local institutions, community organizations that work to operate a commons. So part of the product of the Mayor-Domo project is a recruitment video, which has been produced and is now under copyright and will be distributed. And another is a handbook, which is basically a really practical handbook on how to be a Mayor-Domo, which won't replace working with a mentor, but will sort of complement that process. So this is, both of these projects that I'm talking about are sort of in process right now.
Silvia Rodriguez is Professor Emerita of Anthropology and former director of the Ortiz Center for Intercultural Studies at the University of New Mexico. And on Tuesday, January 15th, she will be speaking about acequias and activism and all the stuff that we've been talking about and more at 5:30 at the Santa Fe Community Foundation, which is on the corner of Helena Street and Paseo de Peralta, B between Old Santa Fe Trail and Acequia Madre, and that's sponsored by Amigos Bravos. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe, and I hope you come back and continue the conversation.
Thank you.